United Nations Radio presents the first of two specially recorded broadcasts telling the Korea story and starring Dick Powell. Those who have made it possible for us to bring you the Korea story come from 21 countries. They number well over a million men. But first, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld.
The whole world is thankful that negotiations at Panmunjom have brought the fighting in Korea to an end by the signature of an armistice agreement. The United Nations Secretariat joins me in paying tribute to the men and women of many lands who have risked or given their lives in the defense of the principles of the Charter. The United Nations will devote the best of its endeavors to the great task of reconciliation and rehabilitation that lie ahead.
Now to tell the Korea story, here is Dick Powell.
If a program can ever be dedicated, this one can, to the memory and sacrifice of the countless men and women at the front and behind the lines who have given their lives, we dedicate this broadcast. This evening, everyone has the right to know how this war began, how it was waged, and how it was stopped. United Nations Radio tonight takes inventory of its files, documents, archives, and recordings, covering more than 1,000 days of bloodshed and peacemaking. Chapter 1 of the Korea Story. For those of you who have not recently traveled to Korea or returned, it lies between the Yellow Sea and the Sea of Japan. Its shores are washed by these waters of the Pacific Ocean. It happens that its name, Chosun, means land of the morning calm. 3 years ago, the troubled morning calm erupted into war. All wars have in common bloodshed, horror, destruction, grief. Most wars have this in common. They rarely settle problems, just trade old ones in for new. What then is different about this war and this truce in Korea? It is a principle, and to understand it, let's go back in history, 18 years. You're in Geneva. The League of Nations is in session. Great statesmen of the day are there. Names half forgotten. Paul Boncour, Sir Samuel Hoare, Laval, Litvinov, Aloisi. No one from the USA. A crowded marble hall, all eyes upon a frail and forlorn figure at the rostrum. His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, the first of Ethiopia. The cause he pleads? To have the League of Nations halt Italy's invasion of his land. What happened then? Speeches of commiseration. Words of anger, words of caution. The League proposed sanctions, but sanctions did not stop Mussolini's armies, nor his ships, nor planes, nor bombs, nor his victory. Aggression seemed to have paid off. It was also contagious. The fever spread to Germany. Japan already had it. Some years later at San Francisco, Anthony Eden said that had the League recognized the threat to collective security inherent in that invasion and taken proper action, the Second World War could have been averted. Back to history again, just 3 years back. The League is long dead. The UN has taken its place. The scene is not played near Lake Geneva, but at Lake Success. The plot is the same. Aggression. June 25th, 1950, Lake Success is bathed in peaceful sunshine. The UN's parking lot, usually filled with cars of thousands of delegates and staff, lies deserted on this quiet Sunday. Suddenly, the weekend calm is broken. Car after car drives in off the Grand Central Parkway as delegates and secretaries alike, some in post-haste, converge upon the long, low building.
Driver for car number 3, report to the dispatcher's office.
The UN Security Council has called together an emergency session. Over the 38th parallel of latitude, invading forces from the north had swept into South Korea. Inside, the Security Council chamber comes alive. The meeting is called order. The Council wants the details of this invasion. Mr. Ernest Gross, representing the United States, supplies them.
At 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, June 25th, Korean dawn, armed forces from North Korea commenced an unprovoked assault against the territory of the Republic of Korea along the 38th parallel in the Yongjin, Kaesong, and Chuncheon sectors, and by amphibious landings on the east coast in the vicinity of Gangneung. North Korean aircraft have attacked and strafed the Gimpo airport in the outskirts of the capital city of Seoul.
Trygve Lie, then Secretary General, takes the floor.
The present situation is a serious one and is a threat to international peace. I consider it the clear duty of the Security Council to take steps necessary to reestablish peace in that area.
And then at 5:15 p.m., Dr. John M. Chang, South Korea's then ambassador to Washington, asks for help.
The invasion of my country is an act of aggression and a threat to international peace and security. I appeal to the Security Council to act forthwith in removing this threat to international peace.
June 25th, 1950, the Security Council puts forth a resolution. Korean forces are to withdraw at once to the 38th parallel. Member states are called upon to give all assistance possible to South Korea and none at all to North Koreans. What was the vote? 9 in favor, none against. Yugoslavia abstained. The Soviet Union was absent. For 6 months, it had ignored the Council in protest over the non-recognition of Communist China within the United Nations. Tuesday, June 27, 1950, the Security Council meets again.
This is United Nations Radio, broadcasting from our booth in the Security Council chamber at Lake Success. Ladies and gentlemen, today's historic Council session on the Korean invasion has just been opened by this month's President, Sir Benigo Rao of India. Sir Benigo has in his hand a cablegram just received from the UN Commission, which has been in Korea for 2 years, seeking to unify that country. The Commission on the spot in Korea has the facts of the invasion. We'll learn them in just a moment. We take you now to the floor. Here is Sir Benigo Rao reading the cable from Korea.
Commission's present view on basis this evidence is first that judging from actual progress of operations, Northern regime is carrying out well-planned, concerted, and full-scale invasion of South Korea.
The chips are down. What will it be, words or action?
Back in the radio booth again, Ambassador Warren Austin is asking for the floor. He too has a message to read, this one from President Truman, referring to the invasion of South Korea and to last Sunday's Council resolution on aid to the victim. Let's go back to the floor as Mr. Austin quotes from President Truman's message.
In these circumstances, I have ordered United States air and sea forces to give the Korean government troops cover and support.
This is one country's reply.
Mr. Austin is now offering a new resolution to the Council. Here is its main provision.
The Security Council recommends that the members of the United Nations furnish such assistance to the Republic of Korea as may be necessary to repel the armed attack and to restore international peace and security in the area.
This spells action. The Council votes. In favor, 8. Against, 1. Abstentions, 1. Absent, 1. The call for assistance goes to 60 member nations. In Washington, President Truman speaks into a battery of microphones.
An act of aggression such as this creates a very real danger to the security of all free nations. The attack upon Korea was an outright breach of the peace and a violation of the Charter of the United Nations. This is a direct challenge to the efforts of free nations to build the kind of world in which men can live in freedom and peace.
Half a world away is Moscow, still absent from the Council. Moscow protests. The Security Council resolution, she says, is illegal. It violates the Charter. Furthermore, any Council action must have the backing of all 5 permanent members. The legal government of China, says Moscow, is kept out of the United Nations. And since the Soviet Union itself was absent too, that action is illegal. Like spectators in a tennis match, the world looks back and forth. July 7th, 1950, the Security Council meets again. It sets up a unified command under the responsibility of the United States. Washington acts at once. General Douglas MacArthur is named as chief. The Council authorizes him to use the UN flag together with those of all nations which will join his command in Korea. July 14, 1950, UN Radio puts in a circuit to Tokyo. UN reporter Mafshin describes.
The United Nations flag flies today over the command headquarters which direct United Nations forces in action in Korea. We stood today on the roof of the headquarters building, a crowd of us in the Tokyo sunshine, as General MacArthur looked up to the silken blue flag, and then the United Nations commander spoke these words.
I accept this flag with deep emotion. It symbolizes one of the greatest efforts man has ever made to free himself. The Far East command will do its best to uphold this noblest of ideals.
By this time, replies from UN member states reach like success.
We're listening to UN Radio. We continue with the list of contributions to the UN forces in Korea, which was released today at World Headquarters. On June 29th, Australia ordered the naval vessels Shoalhaven and Bataan to Korean waters. On July 25th, Turkey placed under the unified command a combat force of 4,500 men. August 4th, South Africa made available a fighter squadron, including air crews and ground personnel. And this concludes our news bulletin to the Caribbean area. This is United Nations...
In Korea, the war is on. In 2 days, Seoul falls to the aggressor. Back for a moment to July 1st. Advance infantry and artillery elements of the United States 24th Division are ordered into battle. It's at Osan Ridge that American troops first meet their new enemy. Other countries of the United Nations pledge troops. Turkey, Britain, France, Canada...
This is UN Radio again. We take you now to Ontario, Canada.
I saw men firing rifles, Bren guns, mortars, and throwing hand grenades. They were shooting at tank targets with American bazookas and learning how to lay and blow up mines and carry out demolitions with high explosives. The Special Force soldiers I visited are members of the 2nd Battalion of the famous Royal Canadian Regiment.
Hello, Paris. This is UN Radio calling Paris. Come in, please.
A battalion of French troops has left Europe to join the UN forces in Korea. This morning, I watched them receive the flag of the United Nations under which they are to fight. The officer in command of the battalion received the blue and white UN banner from General Monclar. He kissed the flag in the traditional French gesture, and the band then plays the Marseillaise. With the brief ceremonies thus completed, the men marched off, detachment by detachment, in sinuous lines that vanished into the morning mist.
An Australian fighter squadron has been operating since the earliest days of the war. A British brigade arrives in Korea in August.
We of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders are very proud to come out here as the first British troops to arrive in Korea and fight alongside our old allies, the Americans.
General Walker is very pleased indeed to see this fine contingent of British troops arrive on the battlefront.
The Philippine Battalion arrives. Then the Turks, Greeks, Ethiopians, Thais, Belgians, Dutch, Canadians, New Zealanders. Later, an Air Force squadron from South Africa. Hospital units from the Scandinavian countries, India, Italy. September 18th, 1950. MacArthur reports to the UN on the magnificent cooperation among the various national forces. But he requests still more troops essential to operations. Soon, units from 16 nations and South Korea are in the field. Above them, the blue and white flag. Before them, the enemy. September 20th, 1950. The 60-nation General Assembly is in session in New York. And while that session takes place, electrifying news comes from overseas.
Here's a report direct from the flagship of the United Nations invasion fleet off Incheon. American Marines have stormed the shore onto two beaches of the port city and within a few hours advanced 2 miles inland. General MacArthur himself is directing the landing.
We move off this ship. Depart. Red ladder. They're on the Faraday deck. That's the deck below this. Port starboard side.
Again, the unified command reports. Military action has broken backbone of invading armies. Capital of Korean Republic, Seoul, is liberated. The people of Seoul welcome UN troops. Transportation facilities are quickly restored as forces move up north. One night, Meredith of UN Radio reports from Seoul.
Here in Korea, I heard the sound of a railway whistle echoing among the barren hills that surround the capital city of Seoul. We heard a whistle way in the distance, and we learned later they've got the trains running up to the Han River, a few miles away.
Blue and white flags make their appearance in Seoul, and badly needed relief supplies arrive. UN units push on past the enemy capital, Pyongyang, towards the Yalu. Now in October, the General Assembly looks toward a speedy end of the fighting and the opportunity of a unified Korean state. October 7th, the Assembly calls for all steps necessary to ensure conditions of stability in Korea. But in November, the situation changes. November 6, 1950, at Lake Success, the Security Council is in session. Ambassador Austin reads this news.
Presently in certain areas of Korea, the United Nations forces are meeting a new foe. It is apparent to our fighting forces and our intelligence agencies have confirmed the fact that the United Nations are presently in hostile contact with Chinese Communist military units deployed for action against the forces of the United Command.
Beneath the weight of overwhelming numbers, the UN forces retreat to the south. Many North Koreans, reluctant to remain up north, move southward, too. Back at headquarters, the United Nations wants an explanation of this new invasion. November 24, 1950. At the Security Council's request, General Wu Shu-Juan arrives from Beijing by plane. But he won't discuss this Chinese intervention in Korea. There are other things he wants to say. Across the council table, Wu Shu-Juan faces Warren Austin as he speaks. Let's listen through earphones to the official interpreter.
Already invaded the territorial airspace of my country. And the airplane thus mobilized reached the figure of more than 1,000. And it has damaged Chinese property, killed Chinese people. And therefore I wish to ask Mr. Austin, do you call this aggression?
November 30th, 1950. The Soviet Union asks the United States to withdraw forces from Korea and Formosa. The Security Council says no, nine times no. In turn, the Council asks all nations to refrain from helping North Korea. Its members now say yes, nine times yes. But there's one no, and from the Soviet Union, it's a veto. Meanwhile, in Korea, the news is bad. Again, the people of Seoul gather their children and meager belongings and trudge south across the snows. UN reporter Meredith stands on the Han River Bridge below the capital. While hapless refugees surge by, he speaks with an American officer.
What are the telephone communications used for here?
Well, to control the flow of refugees across the river and so forth between the police here on the bridge and the police back in town.
If anything goes wrong here, you're able to get the word back quickly.
That's right. Congest too much here, they can hold them back up further in town, and it keeps the congestion from forming down here at the river.
Yeah, but, well, you're doing a grand job here because you're helping an awful lot of people.
Oh, yes. Well, we're glad to help these people and do what we can for them.
December 28th, Lake Success. Along the west wall of the headquarters building, ground floor toward the rear, is what we call the information area. All the teletypes and wire services are there. December 28th, they all break loose at once. This is the news.
14 SSS Tokyo 0945Z. Unified Command reports Chinese forces have crossed Yalu River in strength. Stop. 250,000 men and items.
Lieutenant, can you tell me how it looks up there now with this big Chinese offensive?
Well, I tell you, I've never seen so many Chinese in all my life up there. You can just keep on shooting them down, they keep coming. We had the roads up there today just littered with dead. They just keep right on coming. I think they're doped or something. Hunched down, they got their... They just keep on coming.
There's a challenge. The League of Nations never had to meet one of this magnitude, had never tried. But the United Nations goes on trying. The General Assembly sets up a group to arrange a ceasefire. The United States asks the Assembly to condemn Red China as an aggressor in Korea. Debate goes on. Deep concern over a possible war with China, which could become a third world war, perhaps an atomic war. Plans are broached, proposals offered to negotiate ceasefires with the North Koreans and Chinese. Beijing ignores them all. We're in the Assembly now. This is Sir Gladwin Jebb.
The United States is bearing the major part of the burden of asserting the rule of law. Our forces are fighting alongside yours. You may be certain that in fair or foul weather, where the stars and stripes fly in Korea, the British flag will fly beside them.
February 1st, 1951. Words and patience then run out. The United Nations once more does what the League had never done. By a vote of 44-7 with 9 abstentions, the General Assembly condemns the People's Republic of China as an aggressor, considers additional measures to prosecute the war, and calls for more assistance for this cause. Further pledges of Korea aid come into late success from Israel, Liberia, India, Pakistan, the Philippines. Everything from a field hospital from Italy to 40,000 tons of rice from Thailand and from Denmark.
Denmark is ready to deliver her principal contribution to the United Nations cause in Korea. In just a short while, the hospital ship Jutlandia will leave the port of Copenhagen. Handkerchiefs are waving, and now it's goodbye, Jutlandia. And good luck.
Korea. The Unified Command reports a heavy toll of Chinese and North Koreans. UN forces maintain high morale throughout the winter. The people of Seoul take heart. It's Christmas in Korea, and the children find the strength to sing. It is April now, and General Matthew Ridgway takes over the Unified Command. In New York, Trygve Lie restates the UN's purpose in Korea.
The United Nations has no alternative but to continue the fight to repel and, if possible, end the aggression in Korea with all the force it can safely commit to that action.
On the field of battle, those words are translated into shell fire. UN reporter Meredith takes his microphone up to the lines.
The target is a battalion of Chinese, and they are now moving off. Take the gun down. You can feel the whole earth shake here, and you can hear the sounds echoing amongst the hills from one mountaintop to another. And now I can hear the sounds of the shells falling coming back in a series of dull crumps.
Once again, an enemy offensive has turned back. And up on the lines, those Ethiopian soldiers who remembered must have been more heartened than their fathers who fought alone against Mussolini's legions.
Yes, we feel very proud as Ethiopian soldiers to be part of the United Nations Brotherhood here in Korea.
Part of the United Nations Brotherhood in Korea.
All that spring at Lake Success, a dozen UN delegates assessed the price of peace. It is June 23rd, 1951. And Delegate 11 speaks, in English, Yakov Malik.
The Soviet peoples believe that, as a first step, discussions should be started between the belligerents for a ceasefire and an armistice, providing for the mutual withdrawal of forces from the 38th parallel.
Within a week at the United Nations, the Soviet Union formally proposes that an armistice be negotiated. in the field between commands and solely on military questions, not as China had demanded, on political affairs as well. July 10th, 1951, truce talks begin, first at Kaesong, then Panmunjom. More weeks go by, and months, and then a year. Negotiations are broken off, then resumed. Point after point is hammered out. Point by point, agreement is taking shape. Then but a single obstacle remains. What is to be done with the prisoners of war? The UN will not force reluctant prisoners to go back to what they fear more than captivity. The UN, in a fight for principle, will not give up its principles. And the war beats on. October 14, 1952. Another General Assembly session comes to order. The issue? To resolve the one remaining obstacle to truce, the prisoners. November 19th, a long-awaited plan comes forth.
Call on the delegate of India.
Krishna Menon reads out his plan to 60 delegations. He states a principle.
There cannot be any question of force being used against prisoners of war, and in order that there should be no ambiguity in this matter, therefore is specifically laid down, without any equivocation, without ambiguity, force shall not be used against the prisoners of war to prevent or effect their return to their homelands.
Most delegates are impressed. Then Mr. Andrei Vyshinsky takes the floor. Let's listen through earphones to the official interpreter as Mr. Vyshinsky speaks.
Go ahead and find one word in this draft which will be devoted to the idea that the war in Korea should come to an end. You won't find anything of the sort, no matter how carefully you comb that resolution.
Despite this opposition, the General Assembly approves India's plan and sends it off to China. It is rejected. The fighting flares anew. Once more, truce talks are suspended, and on the field of battle, the troops slug it out without advancing. March 28, 1953, an often suggested proposal of the new UN commander, General Mark Clark, is finally accepted by China's Zhou Enlai. An exchange of sick and wounded prisoners to pave the way, perhaps, for a solid truce. That looks like a break in the stalemate. And as the days go by, sick and wounded captives are returned at Panmunjom. What was their reaction?
An American private first class was carried in on a litter. He tried to raise his head with some effort. Then, in a shaky voice, he expressed his heartfelt gratitude for everything that has been done to return the United Nations prisoners of war. That was what every one of them wanted to say in at least half a dozen languages.
Even as this exchange took place, the war kept on. One offensive, then another, then a third were hurled, but our lines held firm. The aggressor was now fighting behind the line from which he had begun. At Panmunjom, the talks resumed and truce was on the anvil. With each day that passed, though shelling still was heard not far away, at Panmunjom the truce took shape. Hammered, pounded, fired with the lives that lived no more, that truce drew nearer and yet nearer. The rest you know.
We've come a long way since the days when Ethiopia appealed in vain to a League of Nations. Today, a call for help is not ignored in a world of United Nations. The UN's power is not that of the sword alone. Its strength lies in the hearts of those who love peace, and in the mediation which it can exercise in the name of 2 billion men.
United Nations Radio has just presented The Korea Story, starring Dick Powell, and featuring actual recordings from UN archives. Irving Berenson wrote the text. The entire recorded production by Gerald Keane of United Nations Radio.